Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast for people who want to keep up with the headlines and with the news and with international relations, all of it, but who aren't necessarily politics wizards. Sometimes it kind of feels like you need, you know, a degree in this stuff just to understand what journalists and pundits are saying. And that's where I come in. I'm Julia Bell, and I like to kind of bridge the gap and make it all a little easier to digest. And with that being said, today I want to run you through what on earth is going on at the border between Ukraine and Russia. Indeed, Russian troops have been building up a presence along that border, and a big border it is too, and I would recommend having a little look at a map just so you can get a feel for what's happening. But Russian troops have been building up a presence kind of in different positions all along that border since, well, a satellite footage indicates, since November 2021. And that started to make figures like American President Joe Biden, the French authorities, German authorities, and our government here in the UK quite nervous. Questions like, is Russia planning an invasion, started to be asked, which at no point does anyone want to be asking that question, particularly about a country like Russia that doesn't see eye to eye with our leaders, understatement of the century, that also has nuclear arms. Right? We don't want to be dramatically disagreeing over international etiquette with a country that has nuclear arms. That is the most undebatable, uncontroversial sentence I've ever said on this podcast. And what do I mean by international etiquette? Well, to be clear, Ukraine is a sovereign country in and of itself. So if Russia were to, you know, drive its troops over that border and start declaring ownership of Ukrainian cities, areas, it would be categorically breaking international law. But Russia's response really this whole time has been, we're not doing anything wrong. We're carrying out military exercises, drills, if you will. You know, we're in our own country. We're not overstepping any borders. What's it to do with you where we happen to do this? What's it to do with you if there's a big buildup of forces in one spot or in a few key spots? Now, it's important to say here that this brings back a little bit of deja vu, because in 2014, which, I mean, it really isn't that long ago, you know, really 2014, Russia took part of Ukraine, known as Crimea, or annexed it is the kind of official term that people use. It annexed Crimea in 2014. And Crimea, again, if you look on that map, it's like a chunk on the bottom of Ukraine, barely connected. It kind of actually connects Ukraine and Russia. Like, it's a peninsula, right? It's like an island stuck on the end. And literally the Russians went in, took over the Supreme Council, like their parliament, and announced it as Russian, put in a Russian, you know, leadership. And their perspective on it was that, you know, we're taking back Crimea. Crimea was always part of Russia. And indeed, the people there want this to happen. So really, we're just honouring the wishes of Crimean citizens who have their own, you know, they have their own right to decide what they want. And we're merely granting their wish. But Ukraine, on the other hand, along with Britain and America and large sort of swathes of international onlookers, saw that as Russia just willfully ignoring international law, international etiquette. So there was a lot of back and forth at the time as to, well, I suppose it's still now, as to whether Crimea should even be recognised as Russian, despite it having Russian leadership installed. So with that, in very recent memory, I know what I was doing in 2014, you know, that's not a long time ago. You can't help but look at the Russians building up all of this military presence along the border of Ukraine and think, right, okay, what are you doing now? You know? Now, in this episode, I lined up Dr. Trevor McCriskin, Associate Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of Warwick. He taught me, and he was my all-time favourite lecturer. If you know me on a personal level, you'll know, you'll have heard me talk about Trevor McCriskin slightly because I had a little bit of a crush on him, but I'm convinced he's written more books than I've read. And one of his key focuses is American foreign policy. So the relationship between Russia, America, and all of us lot in Europe who do seem to sort of be dragged into this, whether we like it or not. All of that stuff is his bag. This is what he writes about. This is what he kind of lives and breathes. And he ran me through everything really in our conversation, what the Russians might be looking to gain from this, for example. What's up their sleeve? What's their agenda here? And it is interesting that this military threat to Ukraine that's going on, it all does seem to tie in very coincidentally, timing-wise, with this list of demands that Russia has put out. So Trevor sort of talked me through, right, what are these demands? How likely is it that we can negotiate those and maybe meet some of them to make this whole thing go away? So that was some of it. He also talked me through everything all the way down to how this situation might affect our energy bills. But before I get on to him, I feel the need to just point something out so that we are incredibly clear. And that is that even if Russia invades Ukraine, and they haven't yet at the time of recording, and I'll let you know when I am recording. It's 11:15 at night because I'm a nutter on Tuesday the 15th of February. So at this time, they have not invaded Ukraine. But even if they do, our government, the Westminster government, have insisted that they are not planning to send in British troops to fight on the Ukraine's behalf. So in answer to that all-important question that a bunch of you have been asking me on social media this week, are we going to war with Russia? As it stands, no, not in the traditional sense, no. We're not near that point. I can't say it's completely impossible because I don't ever want to say anything's impossible in politics. I've made a few punts in the past and they've usually been wrong because it's always messy and chaotic. But what I can do is tell you categorically what our government are saying. And they are saying, we're not getting our British troops involved. That's very unlikely. And why take my word for it? Here's our Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss. She spoke on the BBC's Sunday morning show about this when they had her on a couple of weeks ago.
But what people want to know is there any scenario in which British soldiers are fighting with Ukrainians they've been training, is there any scenario in which they're fighting with Ukrainians against the Russian soldiers?
That is very unlikely. This is about making sure that the Ukrainian forces have all the support we can give them, whether it's intelligence support, whether it's cyber support, whether it's defensive weapons, which we have been supplying into Ukraine.
But the question remains, even if we're not sending British troops in, what will we do if Russia invade? And how likely are they to do that? And why would they want to? Well, that's where Trevor McCriskin comes in. And I did start our whole chat with the very direct question, are Russia going to invade?
So the Americans and NATO, their NATO allies, believe that, yes, Russia is on the verge of invading Ukraine. They think this because the Russians have assembled a huge force of troops, tanks, armored vehicles, all of that sort of thing, in various strategic positions near to the Ukrainian border, but within Russia.
Yeah.
And so the Russians are saying, why are you all so worried? All we're doing is moving our forces around within our own country. We're doing exercises with our military, but it's completely legitimate and we're allowed to do that because it's our own country. We're also doing it with our neighbours, Belarus, where we have an agreement to do so. Will you please stop worrying? We don't really want to invade. We're not going to invade Ukraine.
But the whole international community is watching on and going, if you're doing so many military exercises, why do they all have to be right by the border of Ukraine? It's all very, very odd.
Yes, well, quite. As we know, Russia is a huge country, right? So they could easily be doing things in more or less provocative locations. And there is good reason to think, because of the history of the relationship between Ukraine and Russia, that there could be an intervention.
Exactly so, because the Russians annexed Crimea. They took over Crimea, which had been recognised as part of Ukraine. And that only happened in 2014. They have this very recent track record, which makes everyone kind of think, right, of course you're capable of doing that sort of thing again. But the thing I want to ask is, what is it that the Ukrainian public want? What's their perspective on this? Because I remember in 2014, the polls in Crimea indicated that the vast majority of people in that peninsula actually favoured Russian control over Ukrainian governance. You know, that was the preference, it seemed. I don't know how reliable those polls were, but it seemed they were perfectly happy for Russia to take over. So what's the feeling like in other parts of Ukraine now that Russia is sort of circling?
So you're right. In Crimea, they held a referendum very quickly after the occupation by the Russian forces. And a very large majority said, yes, we want to be part of Russia. But, you know, again, how reliable those figures were and how much people felt pressured because they'd been taken over, you know, it wasn't a warlike situation, but they, you know, there were lots of forces there that meant that maybe a free vote is not what we saw.
But
there are, as I say, there are these disputed areas of eastern Ukraine where there are lots of people that are fighting against Ukrainian rule and want to be part of Russia. But in the rest of Ukraine, there is much more sort of sentiment towards joining the EU, joining NATO, wanting to be westward leaning, wanting to have a democracy, wanting to have a more stable and peaceful country. And obviously being a member of NATO would give them more protections in that respect. But everything I'm hearing from, you know, friends who analyze what's happening inside Ukraine and the kinds of messages that we've got coming out from there is that they're a lot less worried about this than the West seems to be.
As in Ukraine are what less worried?
Ukraine, yeah. I mean, the Ukrainian president and people within Ukraine are saying, Russia does this. You know, they've done these sorts of maneuvers before. There was a period early last year where they seemed to be amassing troops, but they just do this to sort of, you know, provoke us and to worry us. But we don't really think anything's going to happen. And so what some people observing this are saying is that there is no intention actually on the part of Putin would rather not invade Ukraine because that will bring all sorts of negative consequences for Russia.
So Russia insists they're not invading. Plus, you feel that they'd probably rather not. They'd probably rather that we meet their demands, which we'll talk about in a second what they are. Ukraine isn't necessarily convinced that a full-scale invasion is going to happen either. But it's the Americans and the Brits that are the ones that seem more convinced that Putin might actually go ahead and do this. What is their message then? What is the American, what is the British message to him if he invades? What will they do?
The Americans are saying very clearly, if you invade or you have a military incursion or anything like that, you're going to face massive economic sanctions. We're going to give even more funding because they give a lot of military aid already to Ukraine, but we're going to give even more military aid to Ukraine so it can defend itself. And we're going to reinforce, NATO has forces in Eastern Europe. We're going to reinforce that. We're going to increase the number of soldiers and tanks and everything else that we have in Eastern Europe, which is contrary to what Putin wants.
Yeah, and my dad said this interesting thing a few weeks ago. He was like, Russia and the Russians are obsessed with buffers. They love having like a big, comfortable buffer all the way around the country. So if they can have dominance, control, or at least like averting Western presences in all the neighboring countries around Russia, that's when they feel most comfortable, like a moat made up of other countries. And so, like you say, if America are threatening to just shove loads of Western presence all the way around Russia, then that's going to be like surely quite off-putting for Putin.
So the big Russian complaint for decades has been encirclement by the West. They feel like they're being encircled.
And that's why they don't want Ukraine to join NATO, right?
Because they don't want Ukraine to, because then it will be, you know, it's bad enough that Poland and the Baltic states and some others on their eastern border are NATO members. But Ukraine is like, if you look on the map, it goes deep into sort of old Russia.
Right.
But the overriding thing in the midst of all of this, so these are the things that the Americans are willing to do and NATO allies are willing to do. But there's some things that they categorically stated they're not going to do. And one of those things, they categorically have said they will not send troops to Ukraine to defend Ukraine against Russia.
Right.
And Putin knows that, right? He understands that. So he's able to push and push and push and push on these demands and these threats and make it look more and more like he is going to invade, even if he isn't going to. But he knows that no matter how hard he pushes on that front, the Americans aren't about to send troops to Ukraine. The Brits aren't going to send troops to Ukraine. No NATO member is going to place troops inside Ukraine because it's too risky.
Because they're not a close enough ally, right? They're not a member of NATO. They're not a member of the EU. Are they a member of the EU?
No, they're not. They would like to.
So we don't have that closeness or that responsibility over them. Yeah.
One of the big risks here is that NATO members, so NATO is North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and treaty has within it an article which states that if any one of the member states of NATO is attacked, it's an attack upon all of the members, and that they will undertake what they call collective security. It's collective action then to respond to an attack upon any one of their members.
Mm.
So Ukraine is not a member of NATO. So there's no legal obligation on the part of any other NATO member to intervene if they get attacked.
Right.
They're an associate member. They're a close partner, and they do some joint exercises and that sort of thing, but they don't have that kind of that level of protection.
Okay.
And because of that, you know, and let's face it, because Russia has nuclear weapons and the Americans have nuclear weapons and we have nuclear weapons and the French have nuclear weapons. We don't want to have war with Russia because the chances are it would end up going nuclear.
Oh, man.
And all those fears that we had, you know, for decades back in the Cold War, which seem to have gone away. I mean, they haven't gone away, frankly. But, you know, the fear of nuclear war has been much lower for a long time. One of the reasons I think everyone's getting so kind of wound up and upset and scared about this situation is because they think it will then
become escalate
an actual war between Russia and America. But if you look back at your history lessons, you know, throughout the Cold War, the Russians and the Americans tried everything they could to avoid directly confronting each other. They had all sorts of proxy wars and things like that, but they wouldn't fight directly with each other. They came really close, and there were some times when they mistook what each other was doing and they almost launched nuclear attacks as a result. But they came to an understanding ultimately that they knew, you know, that the whole idea of nuclear deterrence is that it's that
it nobody strikes
too, you know, it, yeah, it's too damaging on you for you to use force against the other. So they both sort of understand that in this situation, they're not going to go that far, right? They're not going to have American troops going in to free Kiev or anything like that.
Hmm.
Where the risks lie is if things don't get contained within Ukraine's borders. Let's say the Russians do invade and it's a massive invasion. They try to take over the entire country instead of some of the smaller kind of actions that they could take. And the fighting spills over into the neighbours who are NATO members.
Right.
Then we're in a different situation, and then we're in a much more dangerous situation. But I think the Russians, if they do invade, will do everything they can to keep it contained within a state that isn't a member of NATO, because they don't want that direct confrontation. They want to push it as far as they can, but they don't want a direct confrontation with a NATO country, with the United States.
But here's my fear, right? And I am a worrier. So I like to think about the worst case scenario all the time. Clearly, there is a horrific breakdown in communication, if there ever was a line of communication between Russia and America. And it's clear, I think, that Russia are being incredibly coy about what they're actually doing. It's so opaque what their actual agenda is. Why have you got this military presence building up in the Ukraine? What do you actually want? Do you want to annex more of the Ukraine? Do you want us to meet your demands? Are you just peacocking to try and provoke us? But,
all of the above.
Right. But my other fear, Trevor, is that it's not like America don't make rash and arguably irresponsible decisions as well. And we've literally just seen President Joe Biden yank Western presence out of Afghanistan. And it was just such an easy takeover for the Taliban. And now human rights in Afghanistan are at such risk, if not, you know, completely fatally destroyed in many respects. And I saw that as a really rash, kind of intense and very mistake-ridden set of decisions. So surely both states are absolutely capable of escalating this, misunderstanding each other, and taking this to a point where we can't come back.
Yeah, they are. So I'll say that, and then I'll say why I don't think it is going to come to that. So
okay. When
I look at all of the evidence that we've got at the moment, it does look to me that, yes, of course, it's entirely possible that what the Russians are intending to do here is to invade or to have a smaller incursion, perhaps go and see some more territory, say north of Crimea, just to see what the reaction really is, to test the West, right?
Right.
Especially after Afghanistan, because the US is looking weak. So let's test them. Let's see how far they're willing to go, which is risky. But, you know, so maybe they'll do something short of a full invasion. But it's really clear that what the Americans are threatening here is not in the, there's not one mention of, if you do that, if you invade, or if you have a military incursion, we're going to start bombing, we're going to start, you know, putting our troops in to defend Kiev. They are not saying that. They're very categorically saying that they won't do that.
Okay.
What they're saying they will do is the biggest set of economic sanctions that they've ever imposed before. And you've got their allies coming out, you know, the allies within NATO, the G7 countries have said that they will support this, that they will come together and they will impose these really strong financial sanctions against companies and individuals within Russia so that they can't do their business around the world. They're
right.
talking about taking them out of the SWIFT international payments system, where if you want to transfer money between countries, there's this, this system called SWIFT that you do that through. And they're gonna say, right, anyone on this list isn't allowed to take part in that. And that would be really damaging, right?
Yeah.
There's all sorts of ways that the US and its allies can make life very, very difficult financially for the Russians. They may even put an end to this really major gas pipeline, the Nord Stream 2, which is going to supply gas from Russia into Europe via Germany. It's completed. It's not yet been brought online because there's some questions over whether it meets European standards. So the German regulator is holding off on it at the moment. But the German chancellor went to Washington last week and Biden got an agreement basically from him that if the Russians invade, and by invade, he means properly physically invade, you know, roll the tanks over the border of Ukraine, they're going to stop that ever coming online.
The gas pipeline. Let's talk about this because I think this is really key, is right now we are all facing a global gas shortage, and that is contributing to, I mean, my listeners will just have heard an episode I did this week talking about the cost of living crisis and how our energy bills are going to cost way more from April and then way more again probably from October because we just don't have enough gas, and so it's costing loads and loads of money. Surely that's even more tense somewhere like Germany, where they've potentially got this wonderful supply of something that we desperately need coming from Russia, and they're watching going, oh God, please can we not have tension with Russia, because as soon as if that happens, then we are cut off from this supply. So I do want to ask, what is Germany's approach to this? Are they taking perhaps a more soft diplomatic approach towards Russia than the UK and America?
So they were being criticised in the US very much for taking too soft a line. And one of the things that I think Chancellor Scholz did last week by going to Washington was to try to demonstrate to the Americans, to the Biden administration, to the US Congress, that he does take this threat from Russia seriously and that Germany is willing to, you know, take a bit of a hit. Because that, I mean, that's the thing with these economic sanctions, you can't put the level of economic sanctions in against Russia without it having knock-on effects on the international financial systems and, you know, the amount of Russian money that's in the UK, for example, you know, and it's just, it will have knock-on effects. But the argument that's being made here is that it's worth it. And so the reason why Germany and America and the UK and other countries are willing to take a financial hit to try to deter or prevent or punish Russia for whatever it ends up doing, is because they believe it's important to send the message, not just to Russia, but to every other nation, that you have to respect the territorial integrity of every sovereign state. And if anyone breaks that rule, then they're going to be punished.
Yeah.
And in some situations, they get punished with counter force invasion, military attacks, etc. So if you go back, you know, to the 1990s when Iraq invaded Kuwait, the response to that was a military intervention to get Iraq out of Kuwait.
Yeah.
Now, doing that with Russia, if Russia invaded Ukraine, it's just far too risky because you'd end up in World War III.
Yeah.
So they're not going to do that, right? They're really not going to do that unless it spills over and there's and everything escalates and there's no stopping it. But they, no one wants that on either side. So instead, you have these other ways of demonstrating to Russia that they really shouldn't be breaking international law, taking over a sovereign state, and that's by using economic sanctions. And that's the and the kind of international shaming and all of that kind of thing that, that goes with it. But it's not the same as say, it's not, this is not 1939, if the Germans invade Poland, we're going to war. It's not, we don't have those arrangements with Ukraine, for one thing. And it's also that we've learned, I think, I hope, from those experiences, that actually going to war with another country can end up being so costly.
Yeah.
And there may be points at which you, you know, the leadership decides they have to do it because otherwise they'll be the next country to get invaded or attacked or whatever. We are so far from that at the moment. We really are so far from that.
I'm just also aware of each Western country is going to want its international image to appear very strong. And I don't know if that's the situation right now. Arguably not really, because like we say, of what happened in Afghanistan, I would have perceived, if I were Vladimir Putin, I'd have watched what happened in Afghanistan. I'd have watched Joe Biden say, enough is enough. We've been in Afghanistan for 20 years. We're out. We leave and suddenly our whole system that we tried to create there crumbles. It feels like overnight the Taliban take over and it's like the easiest, swiftest, kind of most heartbreaking thing to watch. That for me, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, surely projected this image of we America and we the UK and we France and we Germany aren't that interested in overseas affairs anymore. We're just not. We've got bigger fish to fry on home soil because we're dealing with energy crises and pandemics and what have you. And surely for anyone who isn't on our side, quote unquote, like Russia, this is a prime time for them to just start pushing little agendas and little probes they want to make. And I'm worried that if Russia are doing this and we're not really strong, who else has got grand ideas? Who else is watching that? So I think surely our leaders aren't just aware of the principle of trying to protect the sovereignty of Ukraine, but also their own image in how they act on this.
And particularly, as you say, in a situation where you've got a new, relatively new American president who, you know, his first year in office didn't really achieve masses on the foreign policy front, has various question marks over what's going to happen, you know, in the relationship with Iran, the relationship with China. There's lots of points around the world, you know, and you can see that North Korea is taking advantage of the current situation, testing all sorts of missiles at the moment, you know, because they think, well, Russia's kind of preoccupying the US, and so we can now start to prod and push. And so you get a lot of this stuff happening in international relations. Quite from an academic point of view, it's really quite worrying as well, because a lot of what we are looking at the moment is the playing out of what you might call traditional security threats and traditional perceptions of what makes you threatened in the international realm. Whereas actually what a lot of us in academia are saying now is, you know what, that stuff is kind of, it's called traditional and it's, you know, it's kind of orthodox and what have you, because it's fairly old fashioned. It's the way that states have interacted with each other for decades, centuries, whatever. But it's not actually what we need at the moment, because, you know, in 50 years, it might not matter whether the Russians have gone over the border of Ukraine or not, because the world might be on fire because climate has changed so badly that, you know, so there is this sense now that what we really need from our leaders is a transformative form of security policy that doesn't worry so much about who's got the biggest tanks and the biggest missiles and all this kind of macho stuff that often drives international relations. What we need is a really serious coming together, cooperative, collaborative focus on the climate issue, on pandemics, on future pandemics. You know, COVID has been pretty awful, right? But imagine how much worse it could be if it had been deadlier, spread even quicker, you know, and that kind of thing is in our future potentially if we don't try and take collective action to guard against it.
I was going to ask you as well about the UK in this. What's our role? Who are we? Are we playing, you know, you talk about traditional security. Are we playing our old trusted part of America's, you know, top ally? Are we there 100%? Or is there disunity in how the US and the UK are going about this?
So the US likes to have, obviously, it's in this alliance. It likes its allies to go along with it. It likes to have them play ball. Britain, particularly post-Brexit, I would argue, is kind of floundering around a bit, doesn't really know where it fits in the international system.
Floundering around is exactly
what we've had, you know, Prime Minister after Prime Minister saying the most important relationship that we're going to have post-Brexit is with the United States. And so it's really important to stand side by side with the US, all of that kind of that rhetoric. It's also, a cynic might say, it's good timing that this has come along now, because, you know, the UK government, particularly the Prime Minister and his cabinet, are not in a good position politically, are they? I mean, they've got all sorts of things. It seems that every single day we wake up, there's yet another scandalous thing that's occurred, or an accusation, or a
Downing Street party in lockdown.
Another party, you know, yeah. Revelations of things that people are really upset about. And so one great way, when you've got problems at home, when domestically things are going wrong for you, one tried and tested way of kind of deflecting everyone's attention from that is having an international crisis that suddenly means we've all got to go to get, you know, gather together to meet this external threat.
Yes.
So you could cynically argue that that's part of what's happening here and why Britain's going so hard and saying, you know, and that sort of thing can happen even if there is the genuine possibility of a genuine threat, you know, insofar as, because I hope that no one misinterprets what I'm saying here to think that actually the Russians, you know, Putin's a lovely guy and he's never going to do anything bad. You know, it is very provocative. What's being done by Russia at the moment is incredibly provocative, and it allows for the interpretations that the US, the UK and others have got of what his intentions are.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we could have deflated this by not saying, oh my God, it's imminent, they're about to invade, you know, Ukraine, and instead say, you know, we don't think this is an appropriate way to be operating, but we're going to accept for the time being that what Russia is doing here is genuine maneuvers that they're legitimately allowed to do because it's within their country. There are different ways of projecting what you think about something.
Oh yeah, and Joe Biden's rhetoric has very much been, I am extremely worried about war. What is this quote? Like, things could get crazy quickly. And then also very recently, the UK, what was that?
That's helpful, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Actually. And this kind of rhetoric coming from the top. And then the latest response I'm witnessing as of sort of the day of recording is that the UK have said to all UK citizens in Ukraine, get out. That to me screams, get out because it's going to be dangerous soon. So like you say, we definitely are, you know, feeding into this narrative that war is incoming.
Yeah. And it's, so again, in sort of the academic study of these things, there's this idea of securitization, that no security threat in and of itself is a security threat until someone says it is.
Right.
And
yes.
So, you know, Biden and the other members of NATO are very heavily securitized what Russia is doing.
Yeah.
So Russia keeps saying, honestly, we're not going to invade. Will you stop saying we're going to invade? You know, you're just making this situation really dangerous. Stop saying it. And the Americans are saying, but you are going to invade. It's imminent. That's what the Americans are doing, securitizing the actions of the Russians. They're turning it into as strong a security threat as they can.
Why?
Well, partly I think it is because they're genuinely worried that that is what the Russians are going to do, because they've got the track record. So there are some genuine concerns, but equally there are questions about, well, are the Americans partly doing this because NATO needs to have a purpose? And maybe, you know, some of the things that, I mean, Trump really upset a lot of Europeans by saying things like, you know, if you don't pay your way in NATO, we're not going to protect you if you get invaded. So therefore, you know, the sort of degree of trust in the US has been pretty low for a while in terms of whether it would actually be a fully fledged and committed member of NATO. Part of what Biden has tried to do is restore that sense of American leadership within NATO. So is this a way to prove that, by genuinely coming as hard as you can to, you know, say that if Russia acts, then we're going to stand with our NATO allies, etc. But I think all of these factors contribute. And then it does have this sort of snowballing effect, doesn't it? Once you've said they are going to invade, they're going to invade, you have to kind of keep saying it. You can't suddenly go, oh, they're not going to anymore.
Right. You can't change your mind in politics. It's very annoying. I wish we could.
You know, and that is really problematic. But at the same time, I think there are reasons for a degree of optimism here, because there are things that can be done. There is room for negotiation. You know, and the Americans have made this very clear that there's room for negotiation, alongside all of the, you know, the headline grabbing, Russia's about to invade, we've got to get our people out because they're, you know, otherwise they're all going to die in a horrible conflagration. And they, you know, it might come to that, but let's hope not. But alongside all of that, while the Americans are saying, you know, we don't want to ever give up the idea that Ukraine might become a member of NATO, equally, Joe Biden has said things like, well, actually, it's not going to happen anytime soon. Ukraine is not ready to become a member of NATO. You have to have agreement with all the other NATO members before you admit a new member. And there's no agreement. They don't, you know, partly they don't want to admit Ukraine because they don't want to get drawn into a war if there is a conflict that breaks out. Partly they don't want to because Ukraine isn't stable enough yet and doesn't, you know, it's not, it wouldn't be a member that would be as reliable perhaps as other members. And it's so, you know, so the conditions aren't right for NATO to become, you know, for Ukraine to become a member of NATO. And Biden has expressly said that in the last months. And so that gives some room for negotiation. So the Americans don't necessarily want to say it will never be a member, but they could perhaps, through negotiations, which are ongoing with the Russians, it's not that they're not speaking to each other. You know, they're having meetings with each other. Intermediaries are going, and, you know, Macron had his visit last week from France, you know, the French leader, to go and talk to Putin. Putin and Biden spoke at the weekend.
So in theory, we might see America say, look, we won't admit Ukraine to NATO anytime soon. Not saying never, but can you back off, please? And Russia might say, okay, and can you also do this? And America say, well, maybe, yeah.
So this is the thing, right? So Putin made a load of demands at the end of last year, which included saying Ukraine will never be a member of NATO, that other Eastern European countries will either never be members, or they're members now, but maybe they shouldn't be, and maybe you can get them to withdraw. Oh, and by the way, we don't really want you to have any troops in Eastern Europe. In fact, we'd rather you didn't have troops at all in Europe. We'd like to withdraw your kind of gravity bombs and all sorts of things like this. You know, there's all sorts of demands that have been made by Putin, probably knowing that there's not a chance that he's going to get all of those, but he might get some of them. And it's, you know, it's the typical sort of negotiating position that business people take, right? You up the ante as high as you can, knowing that you're not going to, well, I mean, bonus if you get it, but you're probably not going to get that. You'll get somewhere lower down, but you might get more than if you hadn't pushed in the first place. So there's a lot of that stuff going on here as well, I think, on both sides. You know, there's existing agreements between Russia and NATO about conventional forces in Europe, about being transparent about when you're doing a training exercise, that it is a training exercise.
Yeah.
You're not sort of getting ready to invade somewhere. And after the Russians annexed Crimea, they stopped complying with those protocols. So reinforcing those protocols would be a step forward within the Treaty of Conventional Armed Forces in Europe. So that's something they can negotiate.
So we actually have some avenues that haven't been fully explored yet that you're quite hopeful will be resolved diplomatically. There's just one final question. I'm very interested in talking to you about this because I remember learning it under you in your classes. You used to talk about the sort of superpower tension. And that, again, reminds me of like an old world where you've got Russia on the one side and then you've got the US. I think these days people are more focused on China. I remember you talking about America being the key superpower, but how long really is that going to last? And no one can really hold on to that title forever. And I'm just interested if you feel that that has changed. Is America the superpower? And is Joe Biden perhaps going to be this sort of usher to see out its reign? Because we've watched Afghanistan, America did not handle the pandemic particularly enviably, especially in the initial stages. And now, if it's not seen to be super strong on Russia, what happens for the US?
Yeah, I mean, you know, people have been talking about the decline of America since the early 1970s.
Okay. You
know, defeat in Vietnam, Watergate, etc. And all sorts of things that have happened since that suggest that the US is not this great superpower anymore. It's got real limits to what it can do. I think we're seeing that again here. You know, yeah, there are limits to what the United States can do. Probably a good thing that there are limits, because, as I say, they're not about to send troops into Ukraine to start a war with Russia, because that would just be
terrible for us, because we'd get
terrible for everyone. I mean, you know, you're talking, yeah, you don't want to even think about where that could go.
Right.
But so I think, you know, we've had for a very long time now, an attempt at a sort of moving away from there being these, whether it's one superpower, two superpowers, three superpowers, whatever it is. There are states that on the face of it have got more power than others, in that they've got larger militaries, they've got bigger economies, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that they get carte blanche in how to operate within international relations, because there's a lot more interdependence between states than that sort of focus on superpowers suggests. But, you know, I'd like to think that we're going to get to a point where there's more focus on that cooperative, collaborative international relations. The problem is when things like this come along that you realize how far we are from that, because that's not how most world leaders seem to think.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you mentioned China, and we've not really said very much about that. But my goodness, the eyes are on what's happening here from a Chinese perspective, because one of the big question marks of would the US defend people that it said it's going to defend against an external attack is, would the US actually defend Taiwan if China decided we've had enough here, Taiwan is part of China and we're going to take it back by force? And that's one of the, you know, situations elsewhere in the world where they're looking to see what happens here.
Yes, this could set a precedent. Is Taiwan a part of NATO?
No.
Oh, so again, it's a similar scenario.
But there are agreements between the United States and Taiwan about if China were to try to seize Taiwan by force, that the US would defend Taiwan. But it's whether they would actually do it if push comes to shove.
Because that involves war with China, and that all of us can agree we don't want.
And again, you know, one of the reasons why I think that the US and other NATO countries are taking such a strong stance against Russia over Ukraine is because if Russia took Ukraine and they took it without too much consequence for themselves, the next question is, would they try to take back the Baltic states, you know, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, who are now members of NATO?
Oh.
But would the bigger NATO countries go to war over those three countries? Would they actually, you know, fulfill their requirement, their kind of obligations under Article 5?
They'd have to weigh up, it's awful. It's awful to think like that, but they would have to weigh up, is it worth going to full-scale international war?
And so these are the sorts of questions that appear to be at stake here. But none of them are helping us move beyond that kind of thinking to a more transformative view of how do we make ourselves secure? It's by ensuring that the planet continues to exist and works in a way that, you know, is going to benefit all, and we come together to try to arrest the changes to the climate, which might make all of this irrelevant. If the seas rise,
who cares about tanks anymore?
Who cares about tanks anymore?
So that was Trevor McCriskin, Dr. Trevor McCriskin, Associate Professor at the University of Warwick. You can check out all the various pieces of work, books that he's written, and he's also on social media. I'll leave his details below. And if you happen to be a young person going to Warwick University, for God's sake, sign up to his classes. And if you can, I don't know if he'll appreciate me saying this, but I'll say it anyway, nab him as your dissertation tutor in final year. If you are mad enough to be writing a dissertation, which I've never cried more in this short series of time than I did writing a dissertation. And for God's sake, take it from me, don't leave it to the last minute. And I'm trying to remember the title of mine now that we're talking about this. I know what I did it on. It was the topic of American exceptionalism, specifically in Hollywood, and in the media. American exceptionalism is this idea that, you know, Americans see themselves as the good guys, everyone else as the bad guys. We know best. We are the, you know, we are the saviors. We are the superpower. And how that translates, I talked about kind of how that translates in Hollywood. And I was even talking, kind of dissecting Disney films and saying how that sort of American cultural superiority is just hemorrhaging out of Disney movies. And it's kind of instilled in young people from the age of like two. So it was an interesting topic. I cannot remember the title. And I bet if you were to read it now, it would be, you know, cringe.com. but I'll try and dig it up and we can maybe talk about that on Patreon or something. Anyway, I'm digressing massively. I'll put Trevor's details in the episode description if you want to give him a follow on social media. And he often does crop up in the news talking about this sort of topic. I'll add as well, even in the time between when I spoke to Trevor yesterday and putting this episode up for you now to listen to, Russia have actually come out to say, right, okay, we will de-escalate. We will pull some troops back from the border. But even then, our government have been saying they're not satisfied with what they're seeing. So it's as if there's no real, you know, massively material evidence of that de-escalation happening, at least not enough that our government are fully comfortable at the time of recording. And I will say that I've noticed that the rhetoric and the tone from our government and from the Americans as well is that that threat is still there. You know, even though Russia have said, okay, we can pull some troops back, our leaders are all saying, you know, they're worried, this is very threatening. They're talking about this decreasing window of hope for diplomacy and how, you know, they're short on time. It's this very stressful kind of tense rhetoric as if war and invasion is round the corner. We have to prepare ourselves for the worst. UK citizens, American citizens, you need to get out of Ukraine. So that perspective on this is still there, and that it's highly likely. We will just have to see. And listen, like I say, I can do a follow-up episode if that would help you. But in order to keep the podcast going, please do rate it 5 stars. You can rate it on Spotify now as well. And if it's got that big, juicy 5 stars, it does mean that other people can discover me more easily. And of course, please do become a patron. The link is in the episode description. And if you click on that, then you can become part of the community. You can feel confident in the knowledge that the podcast can carry on. And there's loads of bonus content on there for you as well. And with that said, I am going to edit this and then go immediately to bed. Thank you so much for listening. And do you know what I have to say? Thank you for being part of this community. I know that the upload schedule is erratic. I hope you understand I have to fit this around. You know, I do not have a team. Nobody edits this for me. I do it all on my own. And I do have to just try and fit it around my life. But you guys, and the fact that, you know, quite often you'll reach out and say if something helped you or that you're now engaged in a topic or whatever it is, that is why I'm doing it. That is it. And, you know, I would like this to grow and become more of a thing. And yes, that regularity would be lovely if we could get there. But just while this little baby is growing, thank you so much for your support. And thanks for keeping on coming back and listening. And especially those of you who do reach out to talk to me about these things. I absolutely love hearing from you. Like I say, my social media is @JuliaBell_X. And, you know, even though the topics are very often bleak, you guys are anything but. You've been absolutely lovely this whole time. All right. Lots of love. Take care.